WOSU Public Media podcasts are made possible thanks to listener support. All of our digital content, such as Snully Goster and the All Sides of the Ann Fisher podcast, depend on the generosity of listeners like you. You can give at WOSU.org or through the WOSU mobile app. And thanks.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The evacuation of Americans and U.S. troops and Afghan associates didn't go well, and President Biden has seen the disappointment in recent polling. But he has not apologized, and a few weeks ago vowed revenge for the deadly suicide attack on U.S. forces at the airport in Kabul.
To those who carried out this attack, as well as anyone who wishes America harm, know this: we will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay.
Joining us to talk national politics is Ken Rudin, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that at WOSU.org/all sides. Welcome back, Ken.
Good morning, Ann.
So Joe Biden's approval rating slipped to 43%, the lowest point in his presidency, in the latest NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll. It's a big thing. Polling often just reflects change. But what do you make of this?
Well, I think it's deserved. And the reason I say that is because nothing seems to be working especially well, and especially regarding Afghanistan. Look, you know, the president has talked about fulfilling the Trump inclination to get the ending of U.S. troops out of Afghanistan, you know, by this year. But the way it happened, the way our intelligence was so faulty, the thought that we could hold off the Taliban, we, the United States, could hold off the Taliban for several months, if not a year. I mean, that was just the fact that they rushed through the countryside within a matter of days, the fact that the billions and billions of dollars that we've given the Afghan army and trained the Afghan army, only to see them surrender at the first moment of any conflict, was just shocking. And the American people saw it. You know, I mean, whether there's comparisons to 1975 and Saigon, you know, mm-hmm. that's not the issue. The issue is that it was just a total embarrassment. And the last thing Joe Biden wanted was photographs of all these people still stranded mm-hmm. in Kabul and elsewhere in the country who are not unable to get out. And that's just, you know, that's why it's reflected in Biden's plunge in popularity.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We are talking national politics today with Ken Rudin, a political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What does history tell us, Ken, about the lingering effects of this kind of visual demonstration of chaos? I mean, you know, I think Saigon is the most often referenced, but it's not our first pullout.
No, it's not. And we've seen, you know, foreign policy defeats. We saw American bodies being dragged through the streets of Somalia mm-hmm. under the presidency of Bill Clinton. Gerald Ford's defeat in 1976, that Jimmy Carter was really not based on U.S. pullout of Vietnam. But and look, this war was going on for 20 years. As they said, billions and billions of dollars were spent, thousands of American lives and countless number of Afghan lives were lost. And for what? I mean, you know, we came in, the United States invaded in 2001, ostensibly to find Osama bin Laden, more likely to get rid of the Taliban. And the same Taliban leaders that we unseated, I guess, from the government back then are back in power again. And there's no indication that despite some promises or vague promises, there's no indication that they're going to be any less violent and cruel as they were back then. Women are nervous and understandably so. And so all the lives and the money and 20 years of war, I think Joe Biden said, you know, he'd seen enough and had enough. And the American people agree that we've seen enough. But again, the way it happened was just so discouraging and disappointing. And of course, it's easy for Donald Trump to say, you know, he should. I mean, I love the fact that Donald Trump is calling for the impeachment and resignation of Joe Biden. And the Republicans, I bet you, if they win control of the House in 2022, there's going to be impeachment hearings again, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's ugly, it's disappointing, it's predictable. Mm-hmm. But the fact is that it's just a stain, it's an ugly stain on the reputation of the U.S. Because then other countries will say, well, you know, the U.S. promised that you'd stand by us. And after we've seen what happened in Kabul, maybe we can't trust the U.S. anymore. So it's been a kick in the teeth for the U.S. all the way around.
Well, and on the other hand, too, as far as other countries go and our allies, you know, they went there. They were there with us. They're wondering if that's a good idea going forward the next time we get into one of these.
Well, I mean, that of course, that skepticism of the U.S. role in world events, I don't know if it began with Donald Trump, but it certainly was exacerbated by Trump when Trump was mocking NATO members and disparaging NATO and a lot of our allies in Western Europe, saying, what has happened to the U.S.? Joe Biden has obviously tried his hardest to reverse that perception of the U.S. as somebody who just as a country that would just cut and run. But look, I mean, with all that's going on in this country, with the resurfacing of a pandemic that looks like it's getting worse. I mean, now we're having 1,500 people die every day from this from the new Delta variant and the new variant. And Joe Biden was thinking foreign policy was the last thing I expected to be worrying about, but his worries are both domestic and foreign.
Now, an overwhelming 71% of Americans see the war in Afghanistan as a failure. And, well, obviously it is. I mean, you know, whatever you want to say what you see it as. But, you know, just hence, who might be blamed for that? Would it be going there in the first place, which a lot of people think was a bad idea? Then jackknifing over to Iraq for a few years and then going back to Afghanistan. And what do you think, Ken?
Well, there was a great special on this week, basically in about 9/11 and the years and the 20 years since 9/11, put on by PBS. And basically, there's a lot of blame to go around, and justifiably, George Bush, went in to get Osama bin Laden. What was he doing in Iraq? Why? You know, so obviously he didn't get Osama bin Laden. Barack Obama, who promised to end the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and more drones and more people were killed and more troops and more people were killed in Afghanistan under the Obama administration than under the Bush administration. And then Trump comes along, and while he says he wants to pull out from this winless war, he concocts this deal with the Taliban that basically agrees to an early 2021 surrender and a release of many Taliban and Al-Qaeda extremists from prison. This was the Pompeo Trump policy. Mm-hmm. So and then everybody deserves blame, but unfortunately, that we are of the kind of people that loves to point blame instead of trying to figure out solutions. And sure, we can blame them all, and they all deserve blame. But the fact is that, one, we're out, and two, we've left people behind, and that is unacceptable.
Notably, Joe Biden mentioned in one of his speeches about the withdrawal that he was following the lead of Donald Trump, you know, following through, not necessarily with the Taliban, but following through with the withdrawal that Trump had planned before he was lost re-election. Did that get him any points?
No, and as a matter of fact, that was disappointing to me because one of the things one of the many things I didn't like about Donald Trump is that everything was everybody else's fault. Everything that ever was going wrong with the country was either Hillary Clinton's fault, I don't remember her being president, or Barack Obama's fault, or the Bush's fault, whatever. Mm-hmm. He always would blame. So when I heard President Biden talk about, well, the previous administration did X, Y, or Z, that was disappointing to me. Yes, it's true. I mean, Trump deserves blame for accelerating a withdrawal that the military would have liked to have stalled a little bit or made, you know, not as quick. But ultimately, the American people had had enough. There was no reason why any American service member should die in a war that had. It was doomed from the beginning. If it ended 5 years ago, if it ended 5 years from now, there's no doubt in my mind that in any event, in either scenario, the Taliban would have taken over. So why not end it? It just that the advantage Trump had is that he didn't have to facilitate a withdrawal that could have blown up in his face, just as it has with Biden.
Any thoughts about the differing reactions among Republicans to the influx of refugees from Afghanistan? I tell you the truth, I'm not sure where it's at, around 50,000 or 100,000?
I think I've heard at least 100,000. Yeah. I've heard that. And look, you know, it's like so many things, the Republican Party is blaming Bush blaming Biden for letting down many of our Afghan allies. And yet, you know how many Republicans also feel about other people, you know, in quotes, coming into our country. Mm-hmm. And so they're not happy about that either. So again, you know, whatever's happening, it's obviously to the Republicans, Biden's fault, and they will fight him on anything and everything, even though they were probably willing to accept a lot of the Trump policy on Afghanistan. They would accept that because it was, you know, he was a Republican and this is a Trump party. But with Trump gone, let's pile on and blame Biden. Not to say that there isn't reason to blame.
You know, I want to talk about 9/11, but I think I'm going to take a quick break right now. We can get to it when we return. My guest is Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you haven't checked that out yet, we'll have a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question or comment for Ken about national politics, there's, as usual, lots to talk about. So give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@WOSU.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking national politics today with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment about national politics, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Man, it is hard to believe it's been 20 years since the attacks of 9/11, Ken Rudin, but it 20 years is kind of a classic period of time to look back at history and judge it for what it's worth. In a separate Washington Post ABC poll, an increasing percentage, 46% of Americans say the events of 9/11 have changed the country for the worse. It wasn't that way at the beginning, right? At the beginning, it was all, you know, hail, the gang's all here.
Right. It was a rally around the flag feeling, and understandably so. I remember right after 9/11, of members of Congress of different parties would sit together, and they did speak with one voice. You could make the case, and it's a legitimate case, that maybe perhaps the Republican Party used 9/11 as a wedge issue in the 2002 midterm elections, and it gave the Republicans a win in the House and Senate, even though Bush was in the White House. But the feeling was that 9/11 became a political wedge issue. And I kind of agree with that. You know, I thought that after 9/11 that we were united. I thought Bush, I mean, think of Rudy. This is how far long ago it was. Yeah. This was at a time when Rudy Giuliani was seen as a leader and somebody from Earth.
America's mayor. Yeah.
The America's mayor. Now he's become a laughingstock, on so many levels. The fact that he's become a Trump lapdog is just remarkable to see him like that. But it's obviously far more than Rudy Giuliani. It's a backlash against Muslims in this mm-hmm. country. It's a backlash against human rights. It's a rise of paranoia and extremism. And I kind of agree with the poll. The poll is, I don't think we're safer. Certainly. I remember when Saddam Hussein's sons were hunted down and killed, and they said, oh, that's going to change anything. Then they got Saddam Hussein, and that should change something. Mm-hmm. Then they got Osama bin Laden, and that's supposed to change something. Mm-hmm. But there's always people to replace them. There's always another Osama bin Laden on the horizon, be it the Taliban, be it Al-Qaeda, be it, all these extremist groups. So political extremism is here to stay. And the fact is, for all the talk about what happened in 9/11 on and all the hijackers from Saudi Arabia and elsewhere, think of Oklahoma City, think of January 6th. Those terrorists were homegrown. They were not Muslim. They are conservative mm-hmm. Trump supporters. So I kind of think that politics has gone downhill. I mean, you could say it's always been going downhill. And I remember reading stuff about 1960 campaign when liberals and progressives would say, is Jack Kennedy the best we can do? You know, I mean, so everybody's dissatisfied with anything, with everything they're going with at the time. But mm-hmm. I just think that we've gone down a road that it, since 9/11, that we're not, I don't know if we're going to recover from anytime soon, if ever.
Yeah, I mean, coming up, we're going to be talking about how we teach 9/11 20 years later. And in preparing that script, I was thinking about, you know, someone made a reference to the American sense of invincibility was shattered that day. And I'm wondering what you think about how important it is to Americans to feel like we're on top of the king of the mountain, top of the world, the biggest, strongest, the best.
Well, I would make the case that the image of America as the top of the world, the king of the mountain, probably got a major hit during Vietnam when we lost close to 60,000 soldiers. And again, for what? For getting involved in a civil war that when we were forced to leave, with that famous scene of the line jumping on the helicopter on mm-hmm. the building in Saigon. And it was a defeat all around. But 9/11, actually 9/11 almost seemed like a day of, like the one memory of 9/11 I have that I think is a good memory is the thought that the America was united around the cause against a foreign ideology. But too many people have used 9/11 to suppress human rights, to go after people of a certain nationality, did it create Donald Trump? I don't know what created Donald Trump, but the fact is Donald Trump didn't create what's going on in this country. Mm-hmm. It was there, it was picking. Donald Trump took advantage of it and was, became president. So I just think it's just getting worse and worse and worse. So again, King of the Mountain, I kind of think that started in Vietnam. But 9/11 showed that, even though we're separated by oceans, you can't be too safe. And I think people realize that.
My guest is Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. If you have a question or comment for him, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kenny in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Kenny.
Hi.
Hi.
Oh.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Our president can't seem to deal with reality. And by what I mean by that is President Obama left Iraq. He didn't want to, he thought it was an unjustified war, but the point is we were there. And he moved all the troops, and ISIS moved in. Now in Afghanistan, President Biden thought we should have moved, made the comment we should move down in 2010. He was for American troops moving out in 2010.
Yeah.
The point is that the point is that the lie the Biden administration gave was that Afghanistan's soldiers did not fight. They did fight. 68,000 Afghanistan soldiers were killed.
Okay. We aren't going to prosecute this whole issue right here and now, Kenny, but what do you want to, I mean, what's the upshot here?
The upshot is that our presidents make up their minds and don't deal with reality, the reality on the ground. There were Democrats who warned Biden not to leave, and a State Department Democrat, that it would be chaos if we left. But he's determined to leave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I just want to get your opinion on that.
Okay. Thank you, Kenny. Yep. Ken.
Well, again, this is a snapshot, so we are looking at it probably at the worst, for all we know. But Kenny is right. I mean, there is chaos there. Mm-hmm. But yes, the general said, well, why couldn't we have a status quo there when people were not getting killed, when the Taliban was put in check by U.S. presence in Afghanistan? But we were supporting a corrupt government that was just... It just showed that for all the billions of dollars and the two decades of war there, the Afghan army was not being any better trained. The fact that they crumbled at the slightest, the fact that the Taliban started moving and they just surrendered immediately showed that what were we doing there? So, yes, I agree that the withdrawal was messy and ugly, and Biden deserves, blame if things are going to continue to go bad. But I think the alternative of the status quo was just not tolerable. It was not feasible. And I mean, people say, well, why couldn't we stay like we are in Korea? We have troops in Korea, and that's kind of working. But this is not working. And there's the fact is the changing the democratic ideals we were trying to push in a country like Afghanistan was never going to work from the beginning.
An email from Emily. She says, as an independent, I am satisfied with Biden's withdrawal from the country. The dangers are what was to be expected.
The dangers are, look, obviously any withdrawal is going to be messy. Withdrawal after 20 years is going to be messy. But my gut tells me that ultimately this was the right decision to pull out. I mean, Trump was calling for it, and I guess when Trump called for it, the Republicans were all for it too, even though the Republican Party is known for a pro-military exercise kind of party. They were more of an interventionist party, but a combination of the Trump isolationism and Biden, who was basically a dove on Afghanistan, even when he was vice president, I think in the end it's going to be the right decision, but I do worry, as many people do, what's going to become of the Americans and the Afghans people left behind.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Let's see, Mike in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi.
President Eisenhower said a long time ago that the industrial military complex is something we should be aware of. Now, the fact that we were spending $300 million a day in Afghanistan, how much of that $300 million went to the industrial military complex?
Yeah, no, that's an absolute fair question, too. I mean, I've gotten tons of emails since the end of August saying that what we were doing was not, we were spending money not only on a corrupt government there and wasting money on an inefficient army there, but we were also helping defense contractors in the United States. And as Mike says, the military industrial complex, which Eisenhower warned about in 1959, 1960. So there's that too. And, you know, I'm not saying that the US military should not be involved, but this just didn't, I mean, should we have pulled out once Osama bin Laden was killed? But I mean, who knows? But the fact is that there's a lot of money spent going to nefarious people and organizations that should have known better.
The U.S. Supreme Court stayed its hand last week, allowing one of the strictest abortion laws in the country to go into effect in Texas. The law bans abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, well before most women even know they are pregnant, and it gives otherwise unrelated people standing in lawsuits surrounding suspected illegal abortions. Ken Rudin, what does that decision say about where the high court stands now on abortion rights? I mean, bearing in mind, of course, you're not a legal expert, but what do you think about this?
Well, I mean, we've seen this a lot in the press and social media in the last couple of weeks, mm-hmm. that for those who felt, you know, those Jill Stein voters who said there's no difference between Hillary Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, my goodness, just look at the Supreme Court. The fact is that three Supreme Court justices appointed by Donald Trump all let the law in Texas take place, including Amy Coney Barrett, and the other two justices that Trump appointed. Susan Collins, remember when she voted yes on Brett Kavanaugh's nomination, she said, "Well, you know, Roe versus Wade is settled law, and he's not going to change it." This is one of the many mistakes in judgment that Susan Collins seems to say, like voting against impeachment for conviction of Bill Clinton against Donald Trump because he so-called learned his lesson, when mm-hmm. of course he didn't learn his lesson. The fact is that the Supreme Court, the presidency matters, if for no other reason than the Supreme Court, who's going to be on the Supreme Court. And other states are going to now copy that. Other Republican-leaning states are going to copy what Texas did. And ultimately, the Roe decision is in the balance. And of course, Democratic states, liberal states with Democrats in the legislature are going to probably expand a right to an abortion. Republican states are going to do the opposite. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be an issue in the 2022 midterms as well as in 2024. A Republican, usually, if you're pro-life, if you're anti-abortion, abortion is more of an issue, more of an important issue to you than those who support abortion rights. But I think that the liberals have been motivated by what's happening in Texas on so many issues, the voting rights stuff and the abortion issue. And it's going to be a major issue in 2022.
You know, you've already mentioned that similar laws will get enacted, but the fact is that it is not settled law. I mean, the high court did not settle anything in this decision. It just said it wasn't going to take it up until somebody actually litigated it.
Merrick Garland of the Justice Department may be doing the actual litigating. They may bring suit against the state of Texas. So there's no guarantee that the law as passed by the legislature and signed by Governor Abbott will be the law of the land. But there's a lot of disappointment, although it was not unexpected that the court would not stand in the way of a decision that mm-hmm. Texas made.
By the way, speaking of Governor Greg Abbott of Texas, he defended the lack of a carve-out in the new state law for sexual assault victims, saying that Texas would strive to, quote, eliminate all rapists from the streets, which is, I'm sorry, is absolutely absurd.
Yeah, no, I mean, there are so many things that they've said, Abbott, and Lieutenant Governor Patrick and others have said to justify this decision that just absolutely makes no sense. And same with the restrictive voting law that they passed, saying that, well, this is going to cut back, illegal voting. And it's the issues, the instances of illegal votes are just so few. They're basically fighting a problem that doesn't exist. Basically, what it really means is that they're going to do whatever they can to limit the right to vote, the availability to vote, especially in areas where that don't vote the Republican line.
Do you think, you mentioned earlier about, the heartbeat bill there and then the voting thing, is it really lighting a fire under in the bellies of the
conservatives,
not conservatives, but liberals and Democrats?
Yes.
And
oh my goodness, I mean, not that social media is an arbiter of anything and whether or not it shows what America is thinking, but I haven't heard so much talk about abortion not since the Casey versus, Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision many years ago. But people are, what I've seen, people are outraged. And I think it's the left that seems to be most outraged, given the Supreme Court, given the Texas legislature. And it could make a difference. I mean, I don't know, they're trying to get Beto O'Rourke to run for governor of Texas. I still don't know if Texas is going to elect a Democrat to any statewide position, but there's growing anger and, angry people vote. And that's actually, I don't know if this is a good segue to what's going on in California next week on Tuesday the 14th, where the recall election is taking place. But you're wondering, even though that Governor Gavin Newsom is leading in the polls, the fact that the opposition to the recall is leading in the polls, it's the angry people who always vote, and the anger is directed from the right against Gavin Newsom.
Well, and from disaffected Democrats as well, but they didn't put anybody up to run against him, and it does what's there and this huge lineup of people that are on that second question. First, should he be removed from office? The second one is who should replace him. If he wins the first one, then the second one doesn't count. But the fact that the likes of a Larry Elder, a 33-decade-long hot potato of a radio host in California, African-American guy, very, very much of a flamethrower, is the leading candidate to defeat, to replace him, is amazing.
Yeah, well, I think most of America agrees that radio talk show hosts should not be in politics. I think you'll agree with
me. Yes, I will agree with you.
Even though there is even though there is an effort to push you to run for governor next year, but no, that is remarkable. First of all, when in 2003, when Governor Gray Davis of California was recalled, his lieutenant governor, Cruz Bustamante, put himself on the ballot. And the Democrats were furious about this. It basically said, well, it's okay if we recall Gray Davis, because we still have a Democrat who could win. Of course, the Democrat got clobbered by Arnold Schwarzenegger, one of, I think, 145 candidates who became governor in 2003. But that's the reason there's no major Democrat on the ballot next Tuesday. The Democrats said, don't give Democrats an opportunity to vote for another Democrat. It's either Gavin Newsom or nothing. And so Gavin Newsom is probably likely going to win, but there's a lot of reasons why there's such anger against him, especially the way he handled the shutdown of the state businesses and schools in the beginning. There was a lot of resentment about that. But my goodness, Larry Elder, you're absolutely right, Ann. He is a bomb thrower, because that's what he's supposed to do as a radio talk show host. Right. I mean, that's what he does. But he's also been accused of brandishing a gun at his ex-fiancee, which doesn't do. He basically said that, he talked about one woman who was accusing someone of sexual harassment, and he said that she's too ugly to be sexually harassed. I mean, the things he has said is just pretty wild. And there's, besides those issues, there are major childcare and environmental and pandemic issues that would change under a Republican governor, like vaccinations and masks and things like that, and fight for climate control and things like that. So basically, Gavin Newsom was trying to wake up a lot of apathetic Democrats who really didn't think this recall was worth getting excited about. But I think he's done that. The millions of dollars that Democrats have spent fighting this recall, I think, has woken up the Democratic Party, and that's why more will be going to the polls. Of course, 35% have already voted because everybody got a ballot, but I guess the Republican Party is going to lose it. And that's what's so weird about this, because it's a governor's race next year. The same Republicans, I don't know about Larry Elder, but same with some of the other Republicans, John Cox, Kevin Faulkner, other Republicans, are going to run again when Gavin Newsom's term is up. I'm not a fan of recall elections. I wasn't a fan when Scott Walker of Wisconsin, they tried to recall him. I'm not a fan of the Gavin Newsom one. You know, you don't like somebody have a regular election when it's when the term is up, and that's in 2022.
Yeah, because the only winners in this kind of a thing are the people who get the revenue from the ad sales. So
there are a lot of money is being spent. Yep.
We're going to continue our conversation with Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. Moving on, we're going to be talking about the vaccines, the messaging on vaccines, and how the Biden presidency is managing that. And we're also going to consider that $3.5 trillion budget plan and the January 6th investigation. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. My guest is Ken Rudin, a political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast, talking national politics with me today. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So, Ken, a new NPR PBS NewsHour Marist poll shows that the share of adults saying no to a COVID vaccine fell by 5 percentage points in a month. Just 19% of U.S. adults now say they do not intend to get vaccinated. That's a big shift. I don't know if those are the people that have died or what.
Well, I don't think the people who have died have responded to polls, but I do think that people who are in the hospital who have heretofore opposed getting vaccinated because it's a communist plot, that you hear from so many people seriously sick in the hospital saying, oh my goodness, I wish I had taken the vaccination. I wish I had worn a mask. And that is just, it's infuriating. I mean, there are so many people, this is September of 2021, who's getting a vaccination for the first time as if they weren't looking at every news story. The fact is that, you know, a few months ago, the death rate was 500 a day. Now it's 1,500 a day. And there's so many, you know, I keep saying, you know, I mean, I would never celebrate the death of anyone. I mean, that's beyond the pale. But so many, I read about so many political leaders who fought against the vaccinations from day one. They said it was an infringement of our rights, of our liberty, and they got sick and they died within days. And that's so preventable. And part of my argument about Donald Trump and the way he handled the pandemic is that, and I mean, this sounds very harsh, But I think he's responsible, in some ways responsible, for so many of these deaths, who believed him and said that it's not much more than the flu, that it's a plot by the media to defeat him, all those things. And it's like the robots, many vote Republicans have become. They just, I mean, nobody, I can't imagine somebody saying, I'm not gonna wear a seatbelt, or I'm not gonna get a polio shot because it's an infringement of my liberty. It's just, you know, I try to explain the frustration I feel, and it's just so difficult. The fact that this is still being debated a year and a half after people started dying on this, it's just so disheartening.
How do you think President Biden's been doing when it comes to messaging on this topic?
I think he's been good. I think, I mean, I can't say it's a, I mean, the fact that more people are agreeing that that the vaccination is worth it. Look, he can't make everybody get a vaccination, but he's sending the absolute right message that it's ludicrous to not get the vaccination. It's insane not to get the vaccination. He's done everything I think he can do, you know, other than going around the whole country and knocking on everybody's door. So I think, I mean, I know the death rate is increasing on his watch, but it's not because he's not explaining how important the vaccinations are. He's doing that, and sadly, not everyone is listening.
And, you know, how much of his presidency and the politics of his presidency hinge on how the pandemic goes at this point in the U.S.?
Well, I've always said that had Donald Trump taken the pandemic seriously, had he not belittled it, had he been on the forefront of saying how important it was, I think he would have been reelected. I really think that's what did it. And the fact is that the headlines between Afghanistan and the pandemic are just terrible. And crime is up. And crime is up in a lot of the big, you know, the urban centers of the country. Crime is increasing at a very unhealthy rate. So the headlines are not good. Again, you know, they keep saying that, I mean, look, here's another thing. If Larry Elder wins the California gubernatorial race, and something happens to Dianne Feinstein,
who's 88 years old,
he's 88, the oldest member of the Senate, who has had health issues, he could make Mitch McConnell the majority leader, you know, before the midterm election. So much is riding on the election. So much is riding on what happened in 2022. And right now, the headlines are not too generous to the Democrats and Joe Biden.
You know, speaking of Dianne Feinstein and all those that go before her that have worked themselves, usually in the Senate, to their, you know, the end, what do you make of that?
Well, I've seen you know, there was one part time not too long ago. I think it was during the confirmation hearings. I don't know if it was Coney Barrett or Kavanaugh, but she was kind of like very. She was not arguing with the way that, for example, Amy Klobuchar or Kamala Harris was. And there are a lot of Democrats who said she should not be the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee. So, I mean, she's not the, look, Strom Thurmond, you know, and other senators stayed way, way too late, you know, when they were no longer speaking coherently. You know, I can't tell anybody what to do. I don't think Dianne Feinstein feels in her heart that she should be stepping down anytime soon. But then I think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, why should she step down? She's a liberal firebrand, and even though she had recurrence of cancer over and over, she was still fighting. And so why should she step down? And here's why she should step down, because she died and the Republicans refused to allow Obama to pick Merrick Garland. Then they got their own majority on the Supreme Court. So there's so much pressure on like a Stephen Breyer, let alone Dianne Feinstein, to step down.
But in the midst of all of this, she could be grooming a successor. she could be part of, I just don't know who comes up behind her. I mean,
well, there's no lack of ambitious
people
in California. And of course, there would be the governor who makes the decision, not Dianne Feinstein.
Right.
You know, obviously, if she were to remove herself from the scene, the governor would choose a successor.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, just like, you know, when Kamala Harris left the Senate, Governor Newsom named Alex Padilla, a Latino, to replace her in the Senate. When Alex Padilla was Secretary of State, he named somebody else to replace him. In other words, there's a tremendous, because the Democratic base in California has been so unchanged and so old for so long, Dianne Feinstein, Jerry Brown, Nancy Pelosi, I mean, these people are in their 80s. There are a lot of hungry Democrats waiting, chopping at the bit for an opportunity to move up.
Joe Manchin, in an opinion piece in The Wall Street Journal last week, called on his fellow Democrats to take a quote-unquote strategic pause on advancing that $3.5 trillion budget plan. Infrastructure plan, really, is what it is. What's his deal? What's his strategy here, Ken Rudin?
If anybody is holding up the Biden agenda in the Senate, it is probably less so Mitch McConnell and more so Joe Manchin. Mm-hmm. Joe Manchin is a moderate Democrat. Some people will call him a conservative, but he's certainly conservative for most Democrats. And he won't go along with the party. Like, for example, that $3.5 trillion bill about child care and Medicare expansion and family leave and all that stuff. He's saying there's just too much money, while Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders and the progressives are saying there should be more money. He's saying it's too expensive. And I get nervous about Democrats who start, attacking Manchin, saying he's a traitor to the party and he should step down. And why doesn't he become a Republican? And these progressives apparently don't realize that if he became a Republican, Mitch McConnell would be the majority leader. It's a 50-50 Senate. So he and others like Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, they hold tremendous power. David Shipman, who is the nominee for the tobacco and firearms head. I mean, he just withdrew his nomination. He stepped down because Senator Angus King, the independent from Maine, and others like Joe Manchin didn't like his views on gun control, on guns. So, nominally the Democrats have the Senate, they have the House, but they really don't. And they don't have all their party lined up together. So for whatever reason, Joe Manchin has always been a Joe Manchin. He's always been a curmudgeon who sticks by the book, who celebrates his predecessor Robert Byrd's reverence for the Senate, but he's not doing Joe Biden any favors.
And we're just about out of time, but I wanted to talk about the January 6th investigation. A group of 11 House Republicans have sent letters to technology company CEOs last week warning them against complying with subpoenas from the House January 6th Select Committee. Why is this notable? I mean, what do you make of this?
The fact is that Kevin McCarthy and other members of Republicans in the House are doing everything they can to stop an investigation into probably the worst bit of sedition in this country in hundreds of years. And they're doing it to protect Donald Trump. They're doing it to protect the Republican Party in 2022. And the fact is, by threatening these technology companies and trying to fight against any kind of subpoenas of those Republicans who may be involved in January 6th is criminal. It's just a disgrace. And this is what McCarthy's, whole modus operandi is just to protect the Republican Party, protect Donald Trump, and not let the truth get out. And it's beyond shameful. It's criminal and it's awful.
Ken Rudin, thank you so much for your time today. As always, I always appreciate it. It's great to hear from you.
You know, Ann, I always start the show very excited. I always end very depressed. And seriously, when I get off the phone with you, every week I break down and start crying. Well, not really, but.
You know, the times are what they are. We can't fake it.
That's right. Okay. And remember, Ann, don't run for president or governor. Remember that.
No matter how many, all the people out there begging me to do it.
Exactly.
I will not. Okay. Ken Rudin, political journalist, host of Ken Rudin's Political Junkie podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Thanks for your time. Thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.